Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. At the No King's Day demonstrations on June 14th, there were a lot of American flags present. That's not something you typically see at protests attended by progressive activists. But author Paul Loeb, in his book, The Fulcrum, writes about why it's important for protesters to reclaim the flag. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Loeb about his views on a symbol that's often associated with the political right.
You're advocating a different approach to some of these protests, or maybe all of the protests, and you're talking about the use of the flag. And I know that some people have cynically suggested that the way to achieve success in American politics is to wrap yourself in the flag.
Right.
But
right.
The way they mean it is kind of like, you know, don't take it seriously, but just, you know, that's just a way to get votes. But you're kind of saying something else.
One of the things that I've been thinking about is that if I go back 100 years ago, 120 years ago, and I look, say, at the American labor movement, there were always flags. I mean, they were marching, and you know, even like the most radical sectors of it, like the Wobblies, the IWW. I mean, you look at their photo, something like the sort of Lawrence textile strike it was called the Bread and Roses strike, because it was like, we don't want to just survive, we actually want to have decent lives. And there's a photo of them like confronting troops with bayonets with the flags at the front. And then if you look more recently, last 20 years, last 30 years, last 40 years, at particularly progressive demonstrations, they tend not to have the flag. And the flag has, you know, mentioned being people wrapping themselves, and it's sort of been assumed that the flag is a sort of symbol of the political right, and they certainly fly it all the time on, you know, American flags next to a Trump flag. And it strikes me that, I mean, this is true, I would say, in general, but particularly in our current moment where democracy, for all its flaws, is now seriously just challenged and under attack, that being able to make clear that the flag belongs to all of us, represents the best of our democratic traditions as well as the abuses. And I think that's a really important thing to do. And so, you know, it happens that the No King's Day demonstrations are, because it happens to be Flag Day on the 14th, that those are specifically encouraging people to bring flags. But to me, it's also really important. And it's not to say that the flags replace all other kinds of signs or posters or any of that, because to me, they amplify it. And the posters give it, or the signs give it, very specific content. This is what we are challenging. This is what we are standing for. But the flag says, and all of this that we're marching for or rallying for has to do with, at least certainly in these times, with defending democracy, and that this flag is ours as well.
And I guess you're talking also about how it would play to the broader public if you, for example, burn a flag as opposed to carry a flag and say we're proud to be Americans. So it's a little tricky there, I guess, because if you burn a flag, in a way, you're expressing your right to free expression.
Right. And I mean, there hasn't been that much flag burning lately, but there certainly is during the Vietnam era, there were some, and, you know, and never since. And to me, what it does is the message. I mean, it's sort of, you know, it sounds like I am just so disgusted with the flag and that, you know, that I'm going to burn it. But if somebody's watching it and they've revered and say they fought in a war or something like that, hits them really personally. And they take it as an affront. And so if you look at the way that the right-wing media sort of recycled the relatively few images that there are burning the flags, they make them omnipresent. And it's like, these people are outsiders, they hate America, on and on and on. And I think to me, the part of the challenge is, if you're coming from the progressive tradition, which probably a majority of the station's listeners are, not all, but you know, you're thinking, well, here's America that's done these bad things in the world. And you know, no question about that. And you can name lots and lots of wars, and I've certainly marched in demonstrations against most of them. And it certainly continues on. And so those are the reasons, I suppose you could call them legitimate reasons for estrangement. But to me, to say, hey, we are part of this country, we are as legitimate as anybody defending these particular actions, it makes for a stronger case. And it makes for, I mean, the reality is, if we're going to stop the Trump administration's assaults on democracy, those are going to be only stopped with an enormously broad coalition of folks. And it's going to take progressives, and it's going to take conservatives, and it's going to take independents, and it's going to take people from just a wide variety of backgrounds, because that's what it takes to challenge a regime that's basically, from my view, you know, set on destroying all dissent. You have to have a broad coalition, because otherwise they marginalize each other. And sometimes we do get self-marginalized. I mean, this is not exactly the same thing, but it's about marginalization of movements. Is years ago, when was it, 1972, I got kicked out of Stanford University for anti-war activity. And the interesting thing is they kicked out about 100 people that year. They just sort of like, hey, let's just target the leaders and throw them out. Faculty, students, I was a student. And
so they kicked you out for a peaceful protest?
They kicked us out for, I mean, I think we were, in my case, we were in a room with military recruiters, or not really, it was Honeywell Corporation that was manufacturing the cluster bombs. And they were doing job recruiting, and we had pictures of the what the cluster bombs did and showed them, and would you leave? No, we won't leave. And so that was, you know, but it was part of larger campaigns. A few years before, I think two or 3 years before, there'd been a massive sit-in at a military research center that was connected with Stanford. And basically, when they tried to kick people out for that, the faculty ended up supporting the people who were being kicked out. But by the time we came around, basically, it was very split. It wasn't like the sentiment was, how to describe it? It was more anti-war throughout the campus than it had been several years earlier. But there were just all sorts of people who were doing things like trashing windows of bookstores and the library and whatnot. And the people in the movement, it tarred the entire movement. And people basically were just like, you know, these people are crazy. We don't like them. And so I think part of what's
happened, kind of like the black bloc people, and
very much like the black bloc, exactly, very much like the black bloc people. And so what it, you know, and I saw, you know, again, Stanford's kind of an atypical case, but this was just my personal experience, is that had we done the exact same things 3 years earlier, we wouldn't have gotten kicked out. And I think what happens is, you know, and this is, again, there is an impulse. I mean, this goes beyond the flags to the question of violence, property damages and demonstrations, stuff like that. But there's an impulse of anger. Something's happening. It's really bad. You want to resist. You want to strike back in the way, you know, that you feel like is the strongest way. And so you smash a window or a car or whatever happens to be. But what that actually ends up doing, and there's all sorts of research where people have looked at violent movements versus nonviolent movements, or, you know, or even movements that are sort of, maybe that's not violence against people, but the symbols of destruction of property are the ones that get broadcast that strengthen the hand of the regime. And the ones that are nonviolent are just simply a lot more successful. And I think the reason is, and it's similar to the flag, is that they're harder to marginalize. I mean, if you look at the rhetoric of Trump around Los Angeles, you know, there are a very small percentage of the people who are demonstrating burned, you know, like Waymo cars and smashed some windows. And those images, but those images get repeated on and over and over and over again. And, you know, if you watch Fox or something like that, those are the dominant images.
Even if you hear the reporters, even the TV reporters will sometimes say it was a mostly peaceful demonstration.
Right.
That, you're saying that in a way doesn't matter.
Right. That it was, well, it does matter, because it's better than the TV reporters saying it's not a peaceful demonstration. So it does matter. But what it says is that the tendency of the political right and the tendency of authoritarians in general is to basically present this, here's this insurrection, Los Angeles is burning, and so we have no choice but to federalized the National Guard.
Trump was saying the whole city would burn if he hadn't intervened.
Yeah. The whole city would burn if it hadn't intervened. Yeah. And the whole city, you know, you mentioned Portland, you know, they, you know, back in 2020, the whole city was burning. And we have friends in Portland. And it's like, yeah, I'm fighting in my neighborhood. Yeah, there's the Black Bloc crazies down, you know, on a couple of blocks downtown. And so I think part of the challenge, and again, it's not the same issue, but it's related, which is you want to present the demonstrations as basically saying, what is the issue to talk about? The issue to talk about is in this, you know, in our current situation is, are the assaults on democracy? Well, you know, on lots of other issues like that big, what do they call it? You know, big bad bill going through the Senate to gut Medicaid with, you know, not throw 10 million people off Medicaid and Medicare. I mean, a lot of issues. But you want people focused on that issue as opposed to, you know, there are these crazies smashing a window, burning a car, or burning the flag. And then again, with the flag, I think, you know, it's not like it's a magic salve that will just sort of, okay, this solves everything, you know. Suddenly Fox will say, oh, we've seen the light. They're carrying flags. They must be nice people. I'm not naive about that. But what it does is that it basically, somebody's watching it, somebody who's not necessarily politically engaged, somebody who's more conservative, but they're not, you know, they don't want an end to democracy. So they're winnable potentially. And they're looking at that and they're like, okay, these folks are carrying a symbol that I resonate to as well. They embrace that symbol. And I might look at that sign that now that's being carried right next to that symbol. And I think that that's it, you know, it's getting that message out and not marginalizing themselves. You know, to me that just seems, it seems really important. And again, the flags and you know, I have to basically confess that, like, I guess maybe the last 10 or 15 years when there's a demonstration and people are carrying flags, they're like, good idea. They've got a flag. That's great. That makes the rest of our signs more powerful. And then, like, but, you know, would I care if you carry a flag? Well, no, I'll just carry a sign. Yeah. And then it was just like, okay, this is no King's Day. It's Flag Day. And I, like, literally, well, where do you buy a flag anyway? Yeah. I mean, I'm serious. Like, I went online. I was like, okay, how do you buy a flag? Well, I'm not going to buy it from Amazon because I hate Amazon. I know you can buy anything there. But then I was like, oh, my local hardware store has flags. I didn't notice. That must be on an aisle I don't go to that often. Yeah. So I go to my hardware store and, you know, I write up in this piece that's on commondreams.org the other day. And, you know, the woman is sort of, I can tell that is a young woman, African-American woman in this case, and I'm older, an older white guy. And she's kind of, it's like, is this a Trump person buying a flag?
Yeah.
With like rubbing her face or something like that. And I said, well, actually, I'm buying it for, she doesn't say anything. I mean, it's, you know, you can't, it's your, you know, her job's not to like talk politics with customers. But I say, oh, I'm buying it for the No King's Day demonstrations against Trump. She gets this big grin on her face.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, part of it is, again, the reflex action may be, okay, well, that's not me. I'm not going to care. But I actually think, though, that it, again, it doesn't replace any all the other signs. It doesn't replace everything else that's said. But what it does is it says what we are fighting for, and especially now, is this, again, flawed, we know that, but it's a democracy. And compared to the kind of world where the Trump folks want to take us, which would not be a democracy, which would be like, you know, Putin or Orban's Hungary or Turkey. I mean, there's lots of examples, unfortunately, these days.
But for people who, say, on the socialist left, who want to uproot the capitalist system, do you get the sense that they would feel like, oh, my God, I'm carrying the flag of imperialism and I can't do it, that kind of thing?
Well, I think, again, this is why it was interesting to me looking at the Wobblies and, you know, the marches of the labor radicals of the 30s, is they're carrying flags. So, you know, there's two, well, there's really, to me, two separate questions. One is it better to have a democracy or not? And two, well, what kind of economic system do you want? And what do you do with the economic system you have? And are there ways to improve it and, you know, or replace it? But if you lose the ability to have a democracy, then the only possibility of how do you make change? I mean, unless you actually believe that somehow, you know, a small groups of people could take on the U.S. Army. I mean, it's just like fantasy land. So to me, you know, the question of empires, it's tricky. I mean, one of one of my people don't read them much these days, but there was a historian named Appleman Williams, who was one of my heroes. And interesting heritage, because he came out of Kansas, went to the Naval Academy, commanded, I think it was a landing ship in World War II, and then wrote a series of books that during the Vietnam era were the most influential books on young historians challenging that war, and challenging not just that war, but his sort of culminating book was called Empire as a Way of Life. And it was about the ways that basically America has historically taken things that are not theirs. And he's very strong about it. One of the things that he says is the people who, there's also a countercurrent that challenged empire and includes all sorts of people from all sorts of perspectives. So it includes, radicals and radical socialists, and it includes mainstream Democrats, and includes some Republicans. And it's a wide variety of folks. And in his view, all of them deserved honor for challenging empire. And at some points they succeeded, and at some points they didn't succeed. And so even if you believe that the U.S. has elements of an empire, which, if you're going to look historically, certainly has had a fair amount of them, and that some of our actions, Williams died, I can't remember, probably 20 years ago, the action period since continued to do so, you still want to say this flag, it's contested territory. This country's democracy is contested. You can support empire, which we don't like, or you can support an equitable relationship to the world and a democracy at home. And
yeah, there's always been that tension between those who wanted a democratic republic and those who wanted an expansionist empire. And
yeah,
it seems like the forces of empire have usually won out.
Well, they have, sometimes, and there are lots of, Mark Twain, one of America's heroes, was a strong opponent of empire. And, there are
Abe
a lot
Lincoln,
of forces.
Yeah.
Abe Lincoln, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think, in a way, carrying the flag is to me saying, if we're going to go back that far, yeah, I stand with Abe Lincoln, I stand with Mark Twain. I stand with the people. I'm not a pacifist. So to me, World War II was like, okay, you've got Hitler, you have to stop him. And so you are willing to sacrifice your life for it. And I think that that's important. It's also interesting that, if I look internationally in movements that succeed, I mean, it was interesting. This spring in April, I went to Vietnam where I'd never been before. And I got my political start, as mentioned, in protesting that war. So it was interesting to me to go there and, look at how they viewed the war and look at everything that's happened since. And one of the things that was very interesting to me and very unexpected was that when I was going, sort of traveling, I was with a tour group and we went to shrines and looked at the statues and walked around the cities and all that, is that there are these sort of statues or shrines to kings during the 13th, 15th, 12th century who had fought off the Mongols, the Chinese, the Mongols again, the Chinese again. I mean, Vietnam is a country it's been invaded a lot by a lot of other countries. And what I call the Vietnam War and what you probably call the Vietnam War, they call the American War, because before the American War, there was the French War, and there was the Japanese War, and there was multiple Chinese wars. And what was interesting to me is here you are in this, complicated country, because it's got its economy, which has done really well as a market economy, but calls itself a communist country. And you would sort of think that the kings would just be like, hey, this is feudalism. This is not, this doesn't mesh with our supposed vision for the country. But what was interesting is that it was just completely seamlessly, you have a statue of a king on Dien Bien Phu Street. And what I realized when I was talking with different folks about it, it was just like they saw it as a narrative of fighting for national independence. And one of the things that was interesting, and I remember that during the war and was an anti-war activist, is just that we often end up forgetting this point. But at least at the beginning, we kept pointing out that this is a nationalist fight against an external country invading them. And it's
even
really
Robert
hard.
McNamara admitted that later on.
And even McNamara admitted it later on. And that was why it was so hard for this huge superpower, the U.S., and not hard, why they didn't defeat the Vietnamese, is because they were fighting for their country and not just for a particular ideology of Ho Chi Minh and communism and what. And so that's the feeling of you are defending the basis of your country, that runs really deep. I mean, it's the same way in, you know, earlier this year with South Korea. There were flags on both sides because they're protests to keep that you and the president who got impeached. And they're both carrying flags because the flag was the symbol of the country. And so I think it just, to me, it's, again, if I look at successful and unsuccessful movements, the successful ones embrace the sense of we're part of this national heritage. And again, a lot of us who've, you know, marched for Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, I mean, lots and lots and lots of Central America wars. And, you know, it does feel like, oh, I don't want to carry the flag of empire. But again, it's not just the flag of empire. It's a flag that represents, I think, everything that the U.S. is, which is this very complicated country with a lot of contested strains between different visions of where it's going to go.
Paul Loeb writes books on social change. In addition to The Fulcrum, he's written Soul of a Citizen and The Impossible Will Take a Little While. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You're listening to
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. The United States is now fully behind Israel in the war with Iran. Traveling back to the U.S., you may be subject to political tests. And the G7 meetings, a bad day for Trump. First, the U.S. is fully on Israel's side in the war with Iran. Although President Trump tried very hard to suggest that the U.S. is a bystander in the Israel-Iran war, clearly that is not the case. First, he rejected the idea of calling for a halt to the fighting or for de-escalation. The U.S. knew for months of Israel's determination to finish off Iran, yet said and did nothing. Second, the U.S. reportedly shipped 300 Hellfire air-to-ground missiles to Israel shortly before the war began. Third, Axios reports that, quote, the U.S. is helping to intercept incoming ballistic missiles, according to an Israeli official and a senior U.S. official, unquote. And fourth, we're now clearly just a step away from the U.S. participating in Israeli bombing missions. In fact, Trump has used Israel's war-making and threats of regime change to force a deal on Iran. The U.S. side is demanding that Iran cease all uranium enrichment and ship its uranium outside its borders. That deal might now be off the table, but Trump is arguing that Iran's refusal justifies Israel's attacks. He said as much in an interview with CNN, quote, they, meaning Iran, like to talk, but they should have done that before. I had 60 days and they had 60 days, and on the 61st day, I said, we don't have a deal. Iran is not winning this war, and they should talk, and they should talk immediately before it's too late, unquote. Trump repeated this rationale just yesterday. The truth of the matter is that Netanyahu is seeking to accomplish two aims, scuttle any U.S.-Iran nuclear deal and destroy the military leadership and other vital targets in Iran as a way to destabilize the regime. News reports indicate that even an Israeli assassination of the supreme Iranian leader, Ali Khamenei, is under discussion in Tel Aviv. Netanyahu told Fox News on Sunday that regime change in Tehran, quote, could certainly be the result of Israel strikes targeting Iran. The Israeli leader described the Iranian government as, quote, very weak. He has surely said the same to Trump in hopes of luring the U.S. into taking part in bombing Iran's nuclear site at Fordo. With each new day, Trump's position on the U.S. as a supporter of Israel edges closer to direct U.S. military involvement. He had been saying that the U.S. would become involved only if Americans were killed, but then he urged everyone in Tehran to leave immediately, suggesting a bigger war was on the way. He also dismissed the idea of a ceasefire, saying he wants to see a, quote, complete give-up by Iran, with Tehran abandoning its uranium enrichment entirely. Then, in an interview with The Atlantic, Trump said, quote, for those people who say they want peace, you can't have peace if Iran has a nuclear weapon. So, for all of those wonderful people who don't want to do anything about Iran having a nuclear weapon, that's not peace. He may have been addressing supporters such as Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson, who are arguing against involvement. And topping off Trump's movement toward war, on the 17th, he demanded Iran's unconditional surrender, while also saying that, at least for now, quote-unquote, the U.S. would not support killing Khomeini. But the murderous intent is clear, and the good cop, bad cop game continues. With more Israeli attacks forthcoming, possibly with direct U.S. involvement, Tehran is indicating that it is looking for an off-ramp and a way to get back to the nuclear talks with the U.S. Vali Nasser, an Iran expert at Johns Hopkins University, offers this opinion, quote, "The Iranians can't go to the table with their tail between their legs. They need to show that they're still standing, that their nuclear program is still sufficiently strong to merit serious give and take with the U.S., and that they have held their own enough with Israel to actually make the threat that they can unleash on Israel anytime if the U.S. doesn't sign," unquote. But Iran's bargaining position is weakening by the day, and faced with a U.S. president who says, "I don't know what I'm going to do," Iran needs to find a way to get back to the negotiating table. Traveling back to the U.S., you may be subject to political tests. Foreign visitors and even U.S. citizens are liable to be questioned about their political beliefs, especially concerning Trump and Israel, when they enter or re-enter the U.S. The case of Alistair Kitchen, an Australian writer, is not unique. Kitchen had written a blog critical of Columbia University's arrests of students. When he tried to visit friends in New York, Customs and Border Protection, which had a file on him, interrogated him for 9 hours and then deported him back to Australia. Customs and Border Protection told him his writing on Columbia's protests was the reason. Similar cases have been reported. It's a Kafkaesque situation in which no one knows if she or he will be detained merely for speaking freely. As the blogger Tom Hartman writes, quote, "This isn't about national security. It's ideological cleansing. It's the thought police with badges and Department of Homeland Security lanyards." The G7 summit, a bad day for Trump. The meeting of the G7 in Calgary, that's the U.S., Canada, the U.K., France, Germany, Japan, and Italy, ended Monday. They didn't show President Trump at his best. He decided to leave early after at first rejecting and then signing a final document on the Israel-Iran war that supports Israel's right of self-defense and rejects the idea of an Iranian nuclear bomb. Trump embraced Britain, now his best friend. He and Prime Minister Keir Starmer signed a trade agreement, the first and so far the only final agreement signed since Trump launched his tariff war. Speaking to the press, Trump called it an agreement with the European Union. Starmer didn't correct him. Starmer also scored a victory by apparently persuading Trump not to abandon the Australia-UK-US alliance known as AUKUS, to which the British are committing new attack submarines. The rest of the day went south. Trump criticized France's Emmanuel Macron for being a publicity seeker and someone who always gets it wrong on the Middle East. He wrongly accused Canada's former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of having been responsible for Russia's removal from the G8, when in fact Trudeau took office a year and a half after that happened. Trump tried to interest the G7 members in restoring Russia's membership, but that idea fell flat. Trump and Japan's Prime Minister Ishiba were unable to reach a trade agreement that would enable Japan to avoid an economically devastating tariff increase of 25% on cars and auto parts and a 50% tariff on steel and aluminum. "We will continue to actively coordinate with the U.S. to reach an agreement that is beneficial for both countries without sacrificing Japan's national interests," Ishiba told reporters. "There are still some points," he said, "on which the two sides are not on the same page." Separately, Trump told reporters that he had a great conversation with Ishiba and that there was still the possibility of a deal. "The Japanese are tough," Trump said, before characterizing what would happen without a deal. "Ultimately," said Trump, "you have to understand, we're just going to send a letter saying this is what you're going to pay. Otherwise, you don't have to do business with us." Not the kind of comment one makes to an ally. Though Ukraine's President Zelensky was among the outsiders in attendance at the G7, Trump did not speak with him. Nor would Trump sign a G7 statement on Ukraine, saying it would impede his ability to mediate. Russia showed how little it cared about mediation by carrying out another immense strike on Kyiv during the talks. Trump did find time to twice wrongly accuse President Biden of having given $350 billion in aid to Ukraine. The actual figure is half that. In other news, Trump's budget bill eliminates many overseas vaccine programs. Part and parcel with the systematic elimination of vaccine programs and health research in the U.S., the Trump administration is doing the same with international vaccine programs. The Times reports that Trump's budget, quote, proposes to eliminate the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Global Health Unit, effectively shutting down its $230 million immunization program, $180 million for polio eradication, and the rest for measles and other vaccine-preventable diseases. The budget plan also withdraws financial support for Gavi, the International Vaccine Alliance that purchases vaccines for children in developing countries. Overall, the budget request explicitly follows Trump's America First policy, slashing funds for global health programs that fight HIV and malaria, and cutting support altogether to fight diseases that affect only poorer countries, unquote. Health experts are aghast at the administration's absurd justification for the cuts, namely that Americans will not be safer. Clearly, diseases abroad can reach anywhere today, as COVID most recently showed. The U.S. no longer supports Palestinian statehood. U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee dropped a bombshell in an interview with Bloomberg News on June 10.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication